You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
People in law enforcement consider the use of criminal informants as a crucial crime-solving tool. Yet the cultivation and management of the so-called snitches is one of the most secretive and unregulated practices in our justice system. In her new book called Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice, Alexandra Natapoff, who is a professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, looks into the dark side of the practice and its repercussions. The book is published by New York University Press. I'm very happy it has brought Alexandra Natapoff to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
The word snitching has a negative connotation even among school kids. What differentiates it from whistleblowing or other ways that someone might bring a hidden truth to light?
Well, the book is about a public policy. It's a practice of trading information for guilt. And that's really what distinguishes snitching from other kinds of people who give information to the police. This is not a book about people who call 911 or whistleblowers. It's about criminal offenders who give information in order to avoid liability for their own crimes.
And it's usually shown as a useful tool in TV crime shows. How common is its practice how common is it in real life?
As you say, it can be a very useful practice. We think of infiltrating the mob or corrupt organizations, and it can be a very powerful tool. But we use snitching all throughout our criminal justice system, secretively, without much regulation or oversight at all. It touches every facet of law enforcement, from encounters between police and suspects on the street corner to the way we run our jails and prisons, plea bargaining, prosecutorial decisions about who to charge and what to charge them with, and, of course, at sentencing. It's really everywhere in ways that we almost never see.
So there aren't certain types of crimes that call for the use of snitches more than others?
Well, drug enforcement has been the real engine of the explosion of our reliance on criminal informants in our system over the past two decades as a result of the war on drugs. It's sometimes joked in the criminal system that every drug case involves a snitch, but what we mean by that is that every feature of drug enforcement uses informants, relies on informants, assumes that a criminal offender may be part of the decision-making process. And that practice has spread to other areas, white-collar crime, fraud, cybercrime. There is no crime that is exempt from the snitching practice, although drug enforcement is really the paradigmatic example.
If somebody who's been arrested for a crime, for a drug offense, is encouraged by the police to give them another person, is that snitching?
If the deal entails that person getting off from liability for their own offense, yes, that's the heart of the snitching deal.
So how does one become a snitch? The cops just simply say, we can offer you a deal if you tell us some things?
You can become a snitch in many, many ways. You can be arrested on a street corner and the police officer says, I can arrest you now, or I can let you go if you give me a tip. The book starts out with actually a tragic story of the death of Mrs. Catherine Johnston. She was 92 years old in Atlanta, Georgia. The police broke into her house and killed her based on a bad tip from a drug dealer that they had let walk away just hours before. So these tips and these arrangements on the street are pervasive. They happen every day, all the time.
Well, that drug dealer must have known that the cops could come back and get him if he had given them false information.
He must have, and it's shocking how often informants give bad information to law enforcement. Our system is very bad at checking the information received from criminal informants. We have very few mechanisms for following up. Informants who perjure themselves at trial are almost never prosecuted. We're not rigorous about checking the reliability of informant information.
Those kinds of informants are often told that we won't have to bring in a lawyer or anything like that if you just give us this information.
Absolutely. Our criminal justice system has famous rules for protecting defendants and regulating the criminal process, rules that the world admires in our Bill of Rights. Almost none of those rules apply when criminal informants are negotiating with the police. They don't have the right to a lawyer if they haven't been charged yet, if it's an informal negotiation. They have no Miranda rights if they're not in custody. This is one of the reasons why informant practices are so common. They slip under the radar of our protective rules.
Well, don't police departments have some rules for the governing the cultivation and use of informants?
Having rules is the exception rather than the rule. Just this summer, Florida passed groundbreaking legislation requiring police departments in Florida to create new rules where there were none before. Guidelines to help the police figure out who should become an informant, how they should be used. And the reason the legislature passed this these new laws is because of the death of a young woman about a year before, Rachel Hoffman. She was a 23-year-old college graduate, had a bright future ahead of her, but she was caught with a small amount of marijuana and some non-prescription pills. And the police threatened her. They said, "You're going to go to prison if you don't become an informant." And she did. They sent her on a very dangerous sting, and she was killed. And one of the reasons that that could happen is that the police had no rules. They had no guidelines for deciding who is an appropriate informant and who isn't.
So is Florida the only state that has these rules?
Florida is the only state legislature that has now required its police departments to have such rules. The federal government actually is in the forefront in this regard. The Department of Justice has issued over the past decade a series of revised guidelines because the FBI has had such trouble with its mafia informants committing crimes, including murder and racketeering.
In fact, some years back, I had as a guest a member, a man who was in the witness protection program, and he had written a book about his experiences as an FBI informant, informing on Joe Colombo, because Joe Colombo worked in his father's office. And he was very proud of the fact that he committed crimes all along, and he would burgle and do other things. And the FBI protected him the whole time.
Well, this is one of the great compromises of snitching. It requires the government to tolerate crime. It really turns our criminal system on its head.
Because they considered him more valuable as somebody who could tell them about Joe Colombo's activities.
The FBI is just the most high-profile example, but our law enforcement tolerates all kinds of criminality, unreliability, on the sort of assumption that it's more important to protect our sources.
Do the police and prosecutors ever use the law to punish people if they refuse to snitch?
All the time. Ironically, another deep compromise that snitching involves is it rewards the worst criminals because the worst criminals have the best information. I'm thinking particularly of Jack Abramoff, the corrupt lobbyist who, of course, ran rampant on Capitol Hill, violating laws and bribing. His eventual sentence for all the wrongdoing he committed was 4 years. Why? Because he had so much information that the government was willing to cut this very, very generous deal. He would have gotten more time had he sold a tablespoon of crack. So we reward the worst criminals because they have the most information, and at the same time we punish low-level offenders who have nothing to give us.
My guest is Alexandra Natapoff, I'm sorry, N-A-T-A-P-O-F-F. Her book, Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice, is published by New York University Press. Well, in the case of Jack Abramoff, we know, but the use of snitches generally necessitates secrecy, doesn't it? Because if the informant's identity were widely known, that would put him or her in danger.
Yeah, there are all kinds of secrecy associated with the use of informants. Certainly the secrecy as to the identity of the informant with respect to the public or even the defendant against which the informant is used. But secrecy pervades the use of informants. There's a fascinating story about a month ago in St. Louis. The supervisors of the St. Louis Police Department asked of their rank-and-file police officers to give them information about how those rank-and-file officers were using their informants. The supervisors were worried that informants were being relied on who were not reliable, and also that police officers may have been fabricating informants to obtain warrants.
Does that happen? They just make up informants?
Happens all the time. It happened in the Katherine Johnston case in Atlanta that I mentioned a moment ago. It's a well-known phenomenon, even though, of course, it's very hard to track. And so the St. Louis Police Department officials wanted more information. The rank-and-file officers refused to give it to them. They filed a lawsuit seeking a restraining order against their own bosses, arguing that if they were required to reveal how they used their criminal sources, it would undermine their ability to rely on criminals and jeopardize their careers.
And did they get away with that?
So far, it's an ongoing case. But I think it reveals how police officers retreat into secrecy, even from their own colleagues.
Now, you mentioned Jack Abramoff getting a lighter sentence, but you say defendants accused of any crime, from child pornography to rape, even murder, can reduce their sentences by cooperating with the government.
There is no crime that is off limits from snitching.
So what sort of message do you think the U.S. justice system is sending by lessening sentences through cooperation by defendants? Aren't they saying, you can do anything you want as long as you give us somebody else?
Well, it has become a kind of get-out-of-jail-free card. It is well known within the criminal system at every level that providing information is a way of getting out from under your own charges. I tell a story in the book about a decade ago. I was teaching in Baltimore and teaching a law class in a community center in one of the inner city neighborhoods. And a young boy in the class raised his hand. He was probably about 12 or 13 years old. And he said to me, "I got a question. Police let dealers stay on the corner because they're snitching. Is that legal? Can the police do that?" And when I explained to him that, yes, the police have discretion not to arrest an offender if they choose not to, he and his friends were disgusted. They said, "Oh, well, the police aren't doing their job." And another one said, "Oh, well, all you got to do is snitch and you can keep on dealing." That is the message sent by snitching, particularly in communities that have experienced high levels of drug enforcement and criminal enforcement for the past 20 years.
But the cops see these drug dealers as another set of eyes. They're on the corner all the time. They're watching what's going on, and they probably hear about criminal activity all the time.
Some police will tell you that they can't do their jobs without making this compromise. And in the book, I've collected many stories and anecdotes from police officers where they express their deep concern that their job has become relying on and making friends with the very people they're supposed to be arresting and prosecuting.
How can they be sure, as you suggested before, that these snitches can be trusted? For example, the jailhouse snitch. I know if I were in jail and I were in a cell with somebody who the cops wanted to know more about, it would be really tempting to give up some information, even if I have embellished it.
Well, as a general matter, our system is almost completely lacking in ways of checking the reliability of snitches of any kind. But this is a particularly dangerous phenomenon in the jailhouse snitch context. Jailhouse snitches, that is an incarcerated individual who gives information while they're incarcerated, typically about a cellmate or somebody else who's incarcerated, but often others as well. They have proven to be particularly unreliable. I'm speaking tonight at the Innocence Project in Cardozo Law School, and the Innocence Project has, of course, been at the forefront of revealing how often snitches and compensated criminal witnesses have led to wrongful capital convictions.
Can a sentence be lowered retroactively if you give up really good information?
In fact, there's a special provision of federal criminal procedure, Rule 35, that permits a prisoner who is serving their sentence to work off their sentence after they've already begun serving their time by providing information to the government. There are different rules. There's a rule for a one-year time period if you give information within a year after your initial incarceration, or any time after that. And indeed, one federal judge in Louisiana complained that this is a recipe for fabrication. You have people serving 10, 20, 30-year sentences, and you tell them, if at any time you can figure out some information that looks plausible to police or prosecutors, you may get a sentence reduction.
My guest is Alexandra Natapoff, professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Her book, Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice, is published by NYU, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Alexandra Natapoff, a professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, author of Snitching, Criminal Informants, and the Erosion of American Justice, which is published by NYU Press. Since these informants are criminals, by definition, isn't there also a possibility that they'll continue to commit crimes while also serving as an informant or getting off. You get them off, the equivalent of giving them parole, and then they commit a crime again.
Well, this is one of the great costs of snitching that has gone unremarked and undocumented until now. Using criminal informants inherently requires the government to look the other way when crimes are committed. Of course, the crime that the informant has already committed, that's the heart of the deal. They're avoiding punishment for that. But active criminal informants commit new crimes in order to obtain information, usually with government authorization. And then after that, police and prosecutors acknowledge, often ruefully, that the cost of doing business with criminals is that they are going to continue to offend, and the government often looks the other way.
What happens when it comes out in a court case that the police have used drugs as a payment to addict snitches?
There was a scandal just recently here in New York, as you may recall. There were a handful, I think about four, Brooklyn police officers who were caught bragging on tape about their practice of taking drugs from drug dealers, only reporting a fraction of those drugs and keeping the rest of the drugs to pay off their street snitches, essentially funneling drugs to their informants.
But doesn't that undermine their case ultimately?
It absolutely undermines their case. It's illegal. They're not supposed to do it. It's one of the many ways that snitching erodes the integrity of police practices.
And you tell a story of police in Columbus, Ohio, stealing a woman's identity in order to get one of their informants a job as a stripper.
Because working with informants requires the toleration of crime, it erodes all the mechanisms of accountability. People bend rules, break them, slide them under the table. It becomes just a way of managing the means in order to get to the ends.
And they were also having sexual relations with that informant. It seems to me that whenever you step over those lines, you are undermining your case, aren't you? I mean, beyond the fact that this is illegal activity by the police.
It's not necessarily illegal activity by the police to have sexual relationships with their informant. In that particular case that you mentioned, the administrative board held that while their activities were not illegal, they did represent a very bad judgment call.
Bad judgment call.
We do not have rules that make such things illegal. And one of my hopes for the book is that it offers some proposals for creating rules that none of us would object to as unreasonable.
Because you're not saying we should eliminate snitches completely.
I am not saying we should eliminate snitching. In fact, snitching is a function of some of the deepest choices we make about the way the American criminal justice system has run. We give huge discretion to our police and prosecutors, and snitching is part of that discretion. We authorize plea bargaining, the bargaining over guilt. Well, part of bargaining over guilt is bargaining over information. So snitching is really a fingerprint of American justice.
You mentioned the police sending someone into a dangerous situation in which he was killed, a snitch. This happens a lot, doesn't it? People are pressed into becoming informants and then sent out to do the job. Kids, drug addicts, prostitutes, and they're often put into danger as a result.
You're right. Becoming a snitch can be an extremely dangerous decision to make. The law provides almost no protection to informants who risk their lives or well-being in order to satisfy the government's pressure. And one of the reasons why the Florida legislation is so important is not just that it required the police to create new guidelines, but it recognized that informants themselves are often very vulnerable people. They may have substance abuse problems. They may be young or subliterate. They don't know their rights. They don't know what they're entitled to do or what they can be pressured into doing. And when they negotiate one-on-one with the police on a street corner or in a courthouse hallway, they have very little recourse and may agree to things that they're not obligated to do and are not in their interest to do.
You mentioned substance abuse, and you mentioned that that's where most of the snitching takes place. I'm assuming mostly in poor urban neighborhoods.
Well, poor urban neighborhoods pay the highest price for snitching because drug enforcement is so overly concentrated in poor urban neighborhoods. We know that African Americans in particular are arrested and charged with drug crimes far out of proportion to their actual drug use. in those neighborhoods where drug enforcement is a part of daily existence for the people who live there, it means that snitching is also part of the daily existence because we know the drug enforcement relies so heavily on this tactic.
And it's led to resistance to snitching to the point where sometimes that can be counterproductive. Kids are afraid to tell teachers things that they probably should reveal simply because snitching has become such a negative thing in the community.
Well, the stop snitching motto or phenomenon has become something of a phenomenon. A lot of people have heard of it. It has made its way through many cities across the country with DVDs and T-shirts. Young people will often wear a T-shirt that says stop snitching or snitch crossed out with a big red X. And this phenomenon has many meanings. It resonates with a lot of problems with law enforcement in urban communities, but I think it's important to understand that in these communities, they've been living with drug enforcement for 20 years. They've been living with kids knowing that drug dealers are being let remain on the street corners because they're snitching.
But many people interpreted the Stop Snitching campaign as a form of witness intimidation.
It is certainly true that some people have used the Stop Snitching motto as a form of witness intimidation. It's a terrible problem in high-crime communities. It reduces the safety and security of everyone who lives there. I would just note that witness intimidation, and in particular violent witness intimidation, is a long-standing problem. The infamous Stop Snitching DVD that started in Baltimore and kind of made its way around the country came out about 5 years ago. But the Department of Justice issued studies 15 years ago that tracked a dramatic rise in witness intimidation in these same communities as a result of gangs and drugs. So Stop Snitching is a new piece of a much older puzzle.
My guest is Alexandra Natapoff. Her book, Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice, is published by NYU Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Baltimore keeps on coming up. Is the situation worse there than other places? I remember the only TV show I think I've ever seen in which the negative side of snitching was depicted was in The Wire.
And The Wire depicted a very real phenomenon in Baltimore, but in cities all across the country, which is not only the disturbing consequences of snitching, the violence, the unreliability, the switching of sides, but also the relationships between criminal offenders and their police handlers. And I think I've heard many people who watch The Wire say, it can't really be true. It can't really work that way. And one of the things that we find when we delve more deeply into how snitching works is we see that it's very counterintuitive. We have police officers working closely with offenders, sometimes over the course of years, in ways that changes what we think about law enforcement.
But hasn't snitching really helped us break the mafia?
I think the mafia is a good example of the best and the worst of snitching. On the one hand, it certainly has given us prosecutions that we couldn't have had otherwise. Sammy the Bull Gravano testified against John Gotti. We wouldn't have had that conviction
otherwise.
And then
otherwise. He went off to commit crimes.
And then he happened to go off and start an ecstasy ring in Arizona while he was in the witness protection program. So it's an almost perfect snapshot of the costs and benefits. Of course, the FBI is famous for mishandling its informants on the theory that they were such valuable sources, they permitted them to commit other murders, racketeering, other crimes. The Boston FBI office was racked with these scandals for decades. So snitching is not an on-off switch. It's a compromise. It requires judgment and public debate over when it should be used, when is it worth its costs, and when is it not worth those costs. And the problem is that the government gives us almost no information on which we can make a rational decision on that question.
There's a recent film starring Matt Damon about corporate snitching, and that was a perfect example of the kind of positive and negative aspect of snitching.
Yes,
because the guy was a terrible liar, even though he was giving up real information.
Well, The Informant is a great movie to glimpse another phenomenon of informant use, which is that all too often the handlers become so dependent on their informants that they can't see beyond the informant's lies. There's a wonderful study of prosecutors here in New York talking about their experiences with relying on criminal informants. And one of the prosecutors describes the phenomenon as falling in love with your rat. And the prosecutor says, you know you're not supposed to, but it just happens. You get to know the guy and you start to rely on him and you get this warm, fuzzy feeling. That's exactly what happened in the movie. It happens all the time because law enforcement has become so heavily dependent on its criminal sources.
But a corporate snitch does have advantages over somebody who's a criminal on the street level. He has legal representation. I'm saying he. There are women in this as well, but just for grammatical purposes, I will say he.
Well, of course, most criminal defendants are men, although...
Thank you for pointing that out.
although the number of women in our criminal system, of course, is growing as well, also as a result mostly of the war on drugs. But you're right. There are really two worlds of snitching, just as there are, in effect, two worlds of criminal justice, one for the wealthy and one for the disadvantaged.
Every time there is a snitch involved in some kind of terrorist plot, we hear that the person was an agent provocateur. How do we get past that?
It's very hard to get past that for all the reasons that snitches are hard to control. They're hard to track, even for the handlers that know them best. And these problems are exacerbated in the terrorism context, one, because the stakes are so high. The FBI tells us that it cannot make its terrorism investigations without its informants. But at the same time, it's more secretive, more opaque, and less regulated. And so the things that we learn from criminal informant use in our civilian criminal justice system hopefully will be able to give us tools to better understand and better use informants in our high-stakes arena of terrorism investigations.
Well, it's one thing to go after terrorists, and we would like to stop all terrorist activities, but the same sorts of activities were employed during the Civil Rights era, against the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Panthers, other non-criminal organizations.
Although I devote a good chunk of the book to drug enforcement and urban law enforcement, I also cover all the arenas in which informants have been important, as you say, political investigations, the infiltration of the civil rights movement, as well as terrorism, white-collar crime and fraud. And the comparisons between the arenas are very telling. We use informants in different ways, and sometimes they have unique problems, particularly for First Amendment purposes.
We have a caller who's had experiences with snitches. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm okay.
The one point I wanted to make is, well, two, actually. Number one...
But you're a detective?
I am, in the Bronx. Informants are a necessary evil. There is no way that we can see beyond doors. We don't have access beyond doors. Unlike CSI and things like that, we don't know what's going on in an apartment if they're dealing drugs. There's no way we will know unless either we introduce one of our officers, which is completely unsafe, or we use an informant. And it's just the way it is. And due diligence has to be done on the part of the investigator. That's rule number one. You have to fact check everything. You have to keep a constant eye on your informant. You have to control them. And number two, I think there has to be a distinction made between an informant and a snitch. An informant is somebody that's working for a law enforcement agency in some capacity, either working off a sentence, working for money, whatever the relationship is. A snitch, and what we're losing because of the Stop Snitching campaign, is somebody who's not necessarily a criminal, somebody who's not necessarily a habitual offender, who sees something on the street. And because of this whole... the whole mythology and the whole code now on the street about Stop Snitching, these people aren't talking to us about violent crimes that they have nothing to do with. We're losing witnesses. We're losing victims in shootings that will not cooperate because they don't want to be seen as a snitch, and they don't...
John, you're using the word witness and snitch interchangeably?
Well, here's the problem that we're having. We'll have a street crime, a shooting or a robbery on the street. There will be witnesses, but they will not want to be seen as a snitch, so they won't talk to us. They're not necessarily somebody who's going to be an informant or would be an informant in a long-term case. But we're losing these violent street crimes because people are unwilling to talk because of the whole Stop Snitching campaign.
Alexandra?
That's who we're losing. The long-term informants, they're there. They're always going to be there.
Well, John is right that There's a big difference between a law-abiding citizen who witnesses a crime or who would like to come forward to the police but is afraid to do so, and a criminal informant, or often referred to as a snitch, who is getting a benefit from the deal. And our criminal system wouldn't work without law-abiding citizens working with police and giving information. But the use of criminal informants in these high-crime communities is part of a longer legacy of distrust. And law enforcement has been telling us for a number of years that it's very difficult to get witnesses to come forward. The Stop Snitching campaign or phenomenon or whatever we call it is a symptom of a many, many years of distrust that has many features to it. It shouldn't be blamed on a logo or a T-shirt. This is a long-standing problem that's been going on in our cities for many decades.
So have people come up with proposals about getting around the excesses of snitching?
There are many proposals. It's actually an exciting time, I think, at the beginning of a number of very important reforms. Numerous states, including New York, have proposed or considered legislation that would change the way we use informants in different ways. In New York, for example, Assemblyman Lentol introduced legislation a couple of years ago that would require record keeping for the use of informants and put a limit on the kinds of crimes that informants could work off. The proposal would mean that, for example, if you committed a murder or a kidnapping or a rape, you could not get a deal with a prosecutor. You could never work off that crime. At some point, we draw a line in the sand and say justice is not negotiable.
What about committing crimes while you are protected because you're a snitch?
The two congressmen have introduced legislation that would require investigative officers to report the crimes of their criminal informants. And this may seem like a small thing, but it is counter to the culture of secrecy that dominates snitching at this time.
We've even seen some police go so far, I think it was the FBI, where they were tipping off their informants of possible police activity against them to protect them.
Law enforcement will often go to very counterintuitive lengths to protect their information sources. If the use of snitches were more transparent, I think that risk would reduce.
Alexandra Natapoff is professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Her book, Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice, is published by NYU Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.